Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does the frenzy surrounding this month's national party conventions change the way voters approach politics closer to home? And how do perceptions of John McCain and Barack Obama affect the odds for state and regional candidates whose names will appear on the same ballot? Yesterday, we talked with Republican House Leader Jim Cort about the impact of national elections on Texas politics. You can download the podcast if you missed it. Today, we have invited Texas House Democratic Leader Jim Dunham, who represents District 57 in Waco. He serves on the Corrections and the Economic Development Committees, and he was elected to the House in 1996. Jim, welcome to Think.
It's good to be here.
From Reconstruction through the turn of the century, the 21st century, there was always a Democratic majority in the Texas legislature. The Republicans came roaring back in 2002. How do you estimate the chances of reversing the majority this year?
Well, they're really very good. The House went Republican in 2003 largely because of redistricting. The LRB, the Legislative Redistricting Board, which was composed of four Republicans and one Democrat, redrew the House lines. And because of that, I think the Republicans picked up like 16 seats. And that was really the reason that Texas went in the House as Democratic. Since then, we've picked up 9 seats, eight of those through elections, one of those through someone who actually switched parties from Republican to Democrat, which we haven't seen in a long time. And now we stand 5 seats from a majority. And from everything we see in terms of the quality of candidates we have, the fundraising that we've done, and really the responses that the public is giving to some really crazy policies of the Republicans, we feel good about November.
Do you agree that Barack Obama is spending more resources than his predecessors who've held the Democratic nomination or presumably have received the Democratic nomination in Texas?
Yeah, and there's two ways to look at that. One, he wouldn't have to do much to do more than the people have done in the past. The National Democratic Party has pretty much used Texas as a bank to withdraw money and not invest in for at least 15 years, if not more. I remember Clinton came here in 92, but that's the last time I've seen presidential candidates come to Texas for anything other than fundraisers. But that said, I think Obama is going to be working in a meaningful capacity in Texas. I think that it's good that their campaign seems to be one that's going to not just focus on the, quote, battleground states, that they're going to work across the nation. And I think that's a good thing. I think it's a healthy thing for Texas and the country.
You think it's possible that the Obama campaign is doing that just to force the McCain campaign to spend money in Texas that it wouldn't spend?
Well, I'm sure they have their own strategic reasons. But to me, the National Party has made a mistake by just focusing on certain states, saying there's only certain competitive states. And I think that writing off sections of the country is just wrong. In Texas, while they've to some extent been writing off the state of Texas, we picked up 9 seats in the Texas House. We have won some congressional seats. And this session will probably win Senate seats and more House seats. Dallas County, as you know, has turned into a blue county. And I think Harris County is right behind Dallas County. We'll see if they are able to have the same performance this year. But either this cycle or next cycle, I think Harris County will be a Democratic county. And at that point, you'll have all the major urban centers in Texas that are voting Democratic, and statewide races will be coming right behind that.
As just a resident of the state who cares about the people here, regardless of their party, is it a danger if all the cities have a dominance of one party and all the rural areas go to another party?
No, but I don't think that's what we have. If you look at the Texas House, we have a number of a large number of members who represent rural areas. I represent 4 rural counties, including I have parts of the city of Waco, but I also have 4 extremely rural counties. And if you drew a map of the state of Texas, particularly in East Texas, you'll see lots and lots of Democratic state representatives. In West Texas, you'll see the same thing. From San Antonio all the way to El Paso, towards Midland, Joe Heflin out there is a county judge who's a county attorney who won an election and represents probably, golly, 10 counties out there. Pete Gallego represents an area probably larger than most states. So I don't think it's accurate to say that the Democrats aren't performing well in rural areas, or that there are no Democrats out there, because there are, and I represent probably 80,000 people like that. But what we're seeing, though, is, you know, when Texas was Democrat for a long, long time, but that's a little misleading. We had conservative Democrats and more moderate Democrats, and Texas has never been a liberal state in any capacity. And in the late 80s and in the 90s, people became independents, and then they became Republicans. And what we're seeing now is people that were Republican, that are in the suburbs and like that, are now telling us they're independents. They're moving back the other way. And that's why, for example, in Travis County, 6 years ago, there were three Democratic state reps and three Republicans, and now there's six Democrats. The people in Travis County aren't all, you know, the liberals that we think of. If you get into the outlying areas, you have very affluent, very wealthy, very educated people that have been voting Republican for the last 15 years. And they've seen what has happened when Texas turned into one-party rule, which is what really happened in 2003. Before then, we had a real balance. I mean, nobody will say that Bob Bullock was a partisan one way or the other. He governed. He did a good job. Pete Laney did the same thing. And frankly, Bush did it when he was governor here. But when they took over the House, everything really shifted strong to the right. And since then, we've seen policies that I think voters are reacting to, cutting 250,000 kids off CHIP, deregulating college tuition where things are unaffordable now. And if you look at Texas, which is a place I'm really proud of, if you look at rankings, you'll see some problems. You'll see us, you know, number one in underinsured children. Some people will say, well, that's because of illegal immigration. As I understand it, if you took every illegal in Texas and moved them back, we would still be number one in the number of underinsured or uninsured children. We rank near the bottom in teacher pay. We rank near the bottom in home ownership. We rank near the bottom in all of these very important lifestyle categories. And most of that has come about since 2003, when all of the arms of government have been under control of the Republican Party.
Texas House District 57 Representative Jim Dunham is my guest. He is the Democratic leader of the House in Texas. We're talking about state and regional politics in a national election year. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Is there any scenario in your mind in which Barack Obama could take Texas?
Yes, I think so. If we see the types of voting patterns and the types of excitement and energy, and I don't know exactly what it was, but in March there was a sense of chemistry and things coming together in the Obama and Clinton campaigns, where we saw turnout patterns and people voting that we'd never seen before. People will say, you know, oh, well, those were Republicans going over and voting the Democratic Party. Well, that's not true, because if you look at it, the Republicans actually set a record in their own primary. Well, the Democratic turnout was like double the Republican. You go to Collin County, which I don't think anybody is going to say is a bastion of Democrats. Democrats outvoted Republicans in Collin County in the primary. And so I think that if they can put together the same message and chemistry and whatever that dynamic was that saw Obama fill up Reunion Arena, if he can do that in November, then I wouldn't count it out. And I think you may see, instead of us picking up five seats in the Texas House, us picking up a dozen.
Should we be disappointed that Chet Edwards didn't get the vice presidential nomination?
Well, you know, to me, of course, I was disappointed in one sense, because I know of what caliber person he is, what qualifications he has. And, you know, Chet's been one of these guys that I've asked myself for a long time, why isn't he better known nationally? Because he's been there a long time. He's a workhorse. He's done a whole lot. He wins. You know, in McLennan County, where George Bush probably gets, I don't know, 68% of the vote, Chet Edwards will get 68% of the vote. He has the ability to cross over party lines. And it's been, you know, I've observed for a long time, why isn't this guy, you know, getting more attention? Well, frankly, it's because he wants to spend his time working as opposed to being a show horse on all these talk shows and all the TV shows. So people don't necessarily know who he is. So I think that this is actually a great thing for him, but also for the state of Texas, in that he's got national notoriety now. I think he's going to be speaking tonight at the convention in primetime. And I think at this point you're going to see him become more of a national figure, which will help the state of Texas. And you're not going to have me fall over shocked if he's not in the cabinet or in a significant position in an Obama administration.
Jim, you talked about the Democratic majority that Texas used to have shifting in the early Bush years. And what happened was that Republicans started voting independent, and then Democrats voted independent, and then they voted Republican. Now you see the shift the other way. You have some Republicans saying they're voting independent. Presumably, if the formula goes, they would vote Democratic later. I have to wonder, though, how securely you can imagine that you have a hold on those people when perhaps this is a subgroup of Texans who will change affiliation every few years.
Well, you know, to me, and I guess we really all started back with Reagan. I think that you started seeing people, and I remember that's when I started voting. You started to hear people, well, you know, I'm not really a Democrat, I'm an independent, you know, and then 5 years later, those people are saying they're Republicans. I think it's a gradual shift. I don't think it's a, and I think that's what we're seeing now, because all these folks that I run into that I know for 10 years have told me they're Republicans. And I'll say, you know, I vote for the person, and I'm really more independent. I think we're seeing a gradual shift back. I don't think Democrats, any Democrat that takes them for granted or thinks that this is just going to happen because is wrong. We need to have good solutions for the state of Texas. We need to make sure people understand what we stand for and believe in, you know, and we need to remind people what things were like when we had more balanced government in the state of Texas, as opposed to this really very extreme right-wing set of policies that are coming out of the leadership in the House. The truth is, the Texas House right now, if the leadership were removed, would be a pretty balanced and moderate group. The average member, Republican or Democrat, sees things very, very similar. You know, again, in Texas, there's not a liberal in Texas is not the same as a liberal in Massachusetts. Any Democrat that went up to Massachusetts from the state of Texas would be seen as very, very conservative. And I think that it won't take much to get a balance back into the Texas legislature and really get priorities back on what I think people are looking for. And so I think that the challenge for Democrats is definitely not to think this is going to happen automatically, not to think that there's some trend that's coming that's inevitable. It's to continue to communicate the message that we have, and that what we've stood for, and really what we've fought against for the last 6 years since the Republicans took over all branches of government.
How contingent is that balance in the legislature on a powerful figure, someone like Bob Bullock, in the lieutenant governor's office, who really sort of goes, belongs to one party, but is willing to sort of see both sides?
Well, I think that has a lot to do with it. You know, of course, I'm from the House, so we tend to not think of the Senate as very relevant. But
I think they'd say the same thing about
yeah,
you.
Yeah, that's sort of a reciprocal feeling that we have across the aisle. But really, I think what happened in 2003, when you had even, you know, Rick Perry was lieutenant governor, Pete Laney was the speaker, and George Bush was the governor, and you had a need for compromise, a need for balance. I mean, Pete Laney was not some radical liberal person, but he was somebody that was very responsible, and he helped bring balance to the equation. When redistricting happened and the Democrats lost all those seats, you all of a sudden saw a polarization where Tom Craddock came in and everything got extremely extreme, no compromise, whatever they said goes, and that's not good for the state of Texas.
We're talking about Texas politics in a national election year today from a Democratic point of view with Representative Jim Dunham. He is from Texas House District 57 in Waco, and he is also House Democratic leader in Texas. If you want to join our conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Representative Jim Dunham. He is Texas House Democratic leader, and we're talking about state and regional politics in a national election year. If you missed yesterday's program where we talked about this from a Republican point of view, you can find that at the podcast. That's on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join us, you can send an email to think at KERA.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. We have an email from Gabriel who says, it seems Texas has been doing pretty well economically lately. We seem to have jobs and businesses coming into the state. How long can we expect that to continue if we have a terrible education system and growth and so many negative lifestyle factors?
Well, you know, Texas has done well in some cases, but going back to these rankings, we rank down at the bottom in regard to real wages for employees in the state of Texas. And so it hasn't all translated into benefits for all Texans. I mean, right now we're people listening, I'm sure they're paying the highest utility bills that they've ever paid. They're paying as much at the pump as they've ever paid. And I think the gentleman who writes in is right. The problem, one of the solutions to all this is public education. I mean, we cannot sustain a Texas where we are near the last in the nation in high school graduation rates. I mean, we cannot sustain that. Over a period of time, Texas, if we continued these trends, would turn into some kind of third world country because of the needs for social services and things like that, and masses of people who are undereducated and not able to perform at the peak of their potential. So I think what we have to do is these record surpluses that we've been having, and we're supposed to have another record surplus, $10 billion or something this session, we need to invest that in the future of the state of Texas. You can't sustain a system of public education that is designed around the goodwill of teachers. I mean, teachers in Texas are paid between $4,000 and $6,000 below a year, below the national average. That can't be sustained. You can't, you know, in Texas, I mean, Waco right now, they're having a hearing about closing an underperforming school. Well, you know, that campus, the bricks and mortar aren't teaching those kids, and the failure at that campus it has nothing to do with the building or the location of the school. It has to do with the inability to get the qualified and the right teachers in those classrooms with the most challenging children, and that takes resources. I mean, you've got to offer good compensation to get certified teachers in the classroom. Right now, there's 250,000 certified teachers that are not teaching. And if you go to schools that are underperforming, I guarantee you're going to find teachers that are not certified in the subject matter that they're teaching because of the shortages. And we shouldn't have a shortage in the state of Texas when we have 250,000 teachers sitting on the sidelines because they can't make a living wage and support a family by being in the classroom, which is what they want to do and what they love to do. So I think we have to do that. We have to make sure that young people understand that if they apply themselves in public schools, that they will have the opportunity to go to college. And when we deregulated college tuition, when the Republicans deregulated in 2003 and then pulled money away from schools like UT and A&M, you ended up raising tuition automatically and making college unaffordable for people. And that sends the wrong message. If you look at the cuts that were made in 2003, and we did have a shortfall in 2003, and we did have to make some tough choices, but $4 billion was taken out of public education in 2003. And if you look at enrollment growth and just inflation, that money has still not been restored, despite the fact that we've had two sessions of surpluses. The money has been squandered. Exxon has gotten huge tax cuts. The average homeowner has not gotten anything to speak of. I mean, I would be surprised if there's somebody out there whose property tax cut, was not eaten up by appraisal creep. No one got anything in their pocket except for folks like Exxon, and we have less money going into the classroom in real dollars today than we did in 2003, and that's just inexcusable. My son started high school yesterday, started the ninth grade, and I did the math last session. His teachers in his classroom, the average teacher is getting paid less today when he started high school than they were getting paid when he entered kindergarten if you simply adjust it for inflation. Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, those people and professionals in the classroom are doing the most important thing that I can think of for me personally, helping educate my children. I can't think of anything more important to me than making sure that they have a good education. And we are letting them down. And by doing that, we're letting our children down.
Meanwhile, you have a lot of the major districts around the state, including several in this area, that are now sort of giving districts when it comes to the Robin Hood plan, including Dallas ISD this year. Is there a reasonable solution to that without even saying those two nasty curse words in Texas language, income tax?
Yes. The problem with Robin Hood is they stopped funding it. The Robin Hood system worked. And it worked. We would fund the system, and schools like Dallas never had to give money back. What happened was starting in 2003, they started not fully funding the system. We would have, you have to put $1 billion a year new money in the schools every year just to take up enrollment growth. Well, they were not putting in sufficient money to keep up with enrollment growth and other things. And so what happened is the rates at Dallas and other places began to exceed the levels in the formula. So all of a sudden, you had Dallas and Austin starting to have to give money back to the state. It artificially created a crisis by not fully funding the formulas. And so all of a sudden they said, oh my gosh, everybody's in Robin Hood. Everybody's going to have to start giving money back. Well, of course they are, because the Republicans stopped funding the formulas. And I think that instead of taking money out of the system, we should have been putting money in the system, which would have lowered local property taxes on its own. Now, how do you pay for it? There are ways to pay for it that we've continued to propose. The way you deliver real property tax relief and put more money in the schools, one way is you triple the homestead exemption. If you triple the homestead exemption, it puts a lot more money in more people's pocket. It doesn't give huge windfalls to these, places like refinery owners and Exxon. I mean, the largest beneficiary of the tax swap and the tax cut are companies like Exxon, because, you might live in an expensive house, but you don't have property that has the value that Exxon does. What we can do, and what we've proposed in the past, and actually we had the votes on the House floor to pass it, and the Speaker called the day and sent everybody home, but that was to triple the homestead exemption and provide more property tax to more people. And actually, that is cheaper than doing these across-the-board rate cuts that we've had in the past. That frees up significant money, and with the money we freed up, we actually did increase teacher pay to the national average. The money is there. I mean, we've had, eight-figure surpluses now for the last two sessions, and we'll have it again this time. State spending overall is way up. Yet public education and the other things, like even the children that were 250,000 kids that were thrown off the Children's Health Insurance Program, they've not all been restored.
Forgive me for misunderstanding this, for not understanding it. If you triple the homestead exemption, meaning people have a smaller amount of the value of their homes that is taxable, where does the additional revenue come from?
It's cheaper to do that. When you triple the homestead exemption, and frankly, if you triple the homestead exemption or you got it up to $60,000 or $70,000, the average home in my district would not pay taxes, because the average home is worth under $60,000.
So where does money come for schools?
Well, when you do an across-the-board rate cut, you are artificially setting up a system where the companies like Exxon that have tremendous amounts of property throughout the state of Texas, they get huge tax cuts back. Okay, and the average homeowner might get $80 a year, okay, with the same rate cut. What we had proposed doing is you take that money. Let's give the tax cut to homeowners. Let's encourage homeownership, which incidentally we're one of the last in the nation on. And you triple the homestead exemption, and the cost to do that, and which puts double and triple the money in an average homeowner's pocket, is half what it is to do just everything by our rate reduction. So, and we have the specifics of our plan have been out since 2005 when we had the special sessions on, actually 2004, since we had the special sessions on school finance, and we actually had the votes for it on the House floor. It's just the way the math works. You can deliver more money to average homeowners. You still do an across-the-board rate cut, but you don't do the level of rate cut that the Republicans proposed. You do a more modest rate reduction, and then you triple the homestead exemption. That gives more money to more people in their homes, and it's cheaper. It costs less to do it, and it frees up $3 or $4 billion that you can turn around and use to restore CHIP and increase teacher pay.
Texas House Democratic Leader Jim Dunham is with us. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Brett in Dallas. Hello, Brett.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
Great. I love your show. I just want to make a quick comment. My wife is actually an administrator in a North Texas school, and I have a great friend that is a police officer. And I've heard, you know, actually on this show just a second ago and also on TV, that teacher pay has increased. And I think that's kind of a stealth thing that's happened. You know, their top line pay has increased. But I will tell you as a fact that their benefits have been cut tremendously as far as their retirement and additionally what is paid as far as health insurance. I know my wife has a much smaller scope to pick from where she can invest, and also her health insurance has gone from, in the past 5 years, has gone from about little under $400 a month to now almost $900. And my friend that's a police officer, his insurance has actually gone up to almost $1,200 a month. And I think that it's difficult to even think about bringing in new people when your benefits are almost what some of these new teachers are going to make.
Thanks for your call. And I don't think you heard Jim say that teacher pay has gone up.
No, I mean, obviously, I mean, this is one of the tricks that politicians can use. If you have somebody on here, and I didn't hear you the show yesterday, but I imagine Frank Court said that education spending is up. Well, yeah, education spending is up, but we've been adding a Dallas ISD in terms of the number of students every 2 years to the system. So you can go up on spending and not maintain the same level of spending. Teacher pay is up modestly, but, I mean, last session I think it went up $600 or something like that, but that doesn't keep up with inflation. And the cold reality is, even if you forget about the benefits for a minute, my son, Mason, started school yesterday, and his teachers, the average teacher, is making less in today's dollars than they were making when he entered kindergarten, and that's just inexcusable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line is Patrick in Cleburne. Hello, Patrick.
Hello. Jim, it's Patrick Barkman. Good to hear your voice.
Patrick Barkman, how'd you get through?
Well, apparently they're not screening the call.
They should have screened the call.
What's up, Patrick?
Let me embarrass Jim by mentioning how incredibly well thought of and incredibly respected he is by people all across the state of Texas.
I hope my wife's listening.
Not just Democrats, but independents and Republicans of conscience, because he's somebody that has really sacrificed on behalf of the state of Texas and has showed tremendous courage in standing up to Tom DeLay and Tom Craddock. And he's very well thought of by people all over the state. We're very proud of him. But what I wanted to ask him about was, having suffered through two rounds of redistricting myself, what are the prospects of some reform of the way we draw our district lines between now and the time the 2010 census comes along? And I'll just listen off the air. It's nice to talk to you again, Jim.
Thanks for
your time. You know, it probably is not all that realistic, because meaningful changes would probably require constitutional amendments. And there's so much politics involved that I think if we really want to have changes in Texas, we're going to need to have some kind of commission that comes back and makes recommendations. But other than that, you know, it's hard to take the politics out of what is the ultimate political process, and that's redistricting. I mean, you didn't hear me, and I won't complain about the fact that Republicans redistricted the state house in 2003, and they picked up 18 seats, something like that. That's just the way the process works. But you will hear me say that it's not right to do redistricting in 2003, and then when they don't like the fact that Chet Edwards continued to win and Charlie Stenholm continued to win, they said, well, let's redistrict again in 2005, particularly when we have kids going off to health care. We have all these problems with public education. We have problems with our prison system and all this kind of stuff. And so we have, what, four special sessions to redistrict just so Tom DeLay can get rid of Democrats that have tremendous seniority. I mean, if we hadn't had that 2005 redistricting, Charlie Stemholm would be a chairman with incredible power. Martin Frost would be the head of the Rules Committee, which is one of the most powerful committees. Jim Turner would have been a chairman. I mean, they just got rid of unbelievable influence for the state of Texas. And so is the party process going to be political? Yes. But golly, we shouldn't be doing it every 2 years just because, you know, Tom DeLay, you know, didn't have enough power.
Practically speaking, Jim, is it impossible to imagine a time in which everyone agreed that this shouldn't be a political process? Because, you know, you said you weren't going to complain. We know the Democrats have redistricted before to their advantage in the past, and potentially each side will do it again if given the opportunity. What would it take to require that the politics be stripped out of this process to every extent possible?
I don't know how you do it. I mean, I'd be in favor for it if somebody could come up with a solution. But even if you have panels that are, quote, independent panels that are appointed to do stuff, those people still have, you know, some agenda of some sort. And it's maybe just an unfortunate reality. Again, like I said, I wasn't happy about what they did to the Texas House. But, you know, we didn't. You won't find us having complained about it. We did, obviously, take a stand against DeLay's re-redistricting in the mid-decade, but I think we have to avoid that kind of thing, because that what that really does is artificially try to change election results. They changed the map. They drew a new map to beat Chet Edwards. Didn't work. So they redistricted to try to beat him again, and it still didn't work. So how many times are we going to redo it just to salve DeLay's ego?
Texas House Democratic leader Representative Jim Dunham is with us. He is here from District 57 in Waco. We're talking about state and regional politics in a national election year. We'll be back to our conversation in a moment. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking today, the second of our two-part series on state and regional politics in a national election year. Today we're getting the Democratic perspective from District 57 Representative Jim Dunham, who is Texas House Democratic leader. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. I want to talk a little bit about strategy that takes place for the Democrats in this, what we could call an off season, although now everyone's busy sort of running for their seats again. How much in contact do you remain with the other Democratic members of the House when you're not in session?
Oh, I talk to them on a daily basis. You know, we have 71 Democrats in the House now, and I'm in Dallas today, and I'll do my best. Now, some of them are at the National Convention, but I will do my best to go by and see some of them. I'm going to go to lunch with one of them when I get done today, and I'm on the phone with them pretty regularly. And we also have staff members that are actually talking to 4 or 5 to 10 campaigns a day, just about what they're doing and what's going on and that kind of stuff.
Do you have a big chart in your office of who's doing how well? I guess there aren't polls for a lot of these smaller elections.
Well, there actually are. I mean, you'd be surprised at the amount of money that's spent on these races. It boggles my mind. I mean, an average House race in Dallas County, you'll see $1 million spent combined on both sides, which is just remarkable for a $600 a month job. And I think when I ran the first time, I spent $60,000 or something like that, and I thought that was a whole lot of money. But if you're going to spend $500,000 on a race, you'll often see polls done because you don't want to you want to be smart on how you spend your money. And I'll tell you, we're doing good. People are finally aware of what the Republicans have done, and you know they made all these promises, and you know things aren't living up to those promises, and people are responding. And I think that we've got the best thing is we have really good qualified people that are running as Democrats, and that hasn't always been the case. We have now people that are coming and saying, you know what, I want to get involved. Somebody's got to do something about this, and I'm tired of sitting on my couch complaining. I'm going to do something. And these are people that are very, very qualified, very, very smart, very dedicated, have the right motivations. And I think that is why we've picked up 9 seats in the last six years. It's because of the quality of people that have said they've had enough and they're going to run as Democrat.
Is there a list of agenda items or platform points that Texas Democrats are all asked to sort of pledge to support?
No. In fact, if we suggested something like that, I think I'd probably get thrown off a building. Texas Democrats are very, very independent-minded people. We don't, you know, you hear about in Washington, the Republicans and the Democrats, you know, they vote along party lines and party leadership tells them this and that. You know, I've been the House Democratic leader since 2003, and if I told people they needed to do this or that because of the good of the party, they would vote the opposite just on principle. That's sort of the way Texas Democrats are. They're the elected officials. They're very independent. They don't like to be told what to do. They grew up politically under Pete Laney, whose mantra was vote your district and politics be damned. And that's the way that our delegation is. And sometimes it's frustrating, you know, trying to be caucus chair of a bunch of folks like that. But frankly, it's the best way. It's the way it ought to be. I don't want to ask somebody to vote against their district. I mean, that's why I think we had Kirk England in Grand Prairie switch parties, because he got tired of the Republican leadership telling him to vote against his district. And finally, he just said, look, you know, I'm going to vote for my district, and I'm tired of people telling me what to do. And Democrats aren't going to tell me what to do, because he had seen us on the floor, that we didn't strong arm people. We just say, this is what we think is right, and if you agree with us, vote with us. If not, fine. That's sort of the way it is. We are not a disciplined political machine. We're just mainly a lot of folks trying to do the right thing.
How often are the big fights on the floor of the House not personal, and how often do they sort of carry with them some sort of ongoing resentment from the two people? And I'm thinking maybe on both sides of the aisle. How often do they really kind of?
I don't think in the Texas House there's a lot of personal animosity among membership. I mean, I've been as strong and in your face on debates against the other side as anybody. And when everything's said and done, I go out to dinner with folks and we move on. I think that we all advocate positions. We advocate them strongly. We feel strongly about them. But anybody that takes it personal, I think, is shouldn't be in politics. Because it's not personal. I mean, if I think it's wrong that the Republicans have put 250,000 kids off of children's health insurance, you know, I'm going to say it's wrong, and I'm going to fight awful hard against it. I choose not to believe that the Republicans are doing that because they're evil or evil-minded people. For whatever reason, they don't think it's the function of state government to insure children. That's a position they have, and I can disagree with that very, very strongly. But I'm not going to say that it makes them bad people. That's not where I come from.
Now, is that what you're talking about when you go out to dinner, or do you stick to the cowboys and your kids? And
well, sometimes we talk about policy. I mean, many debates are not won on the House floor. They're won through discussions off the House floor, and you're always talking about, you know, issues and trying to persuade people on positions. So no, it's not a, you know, when we're in Austin, one of the good things about Texas government is we don't meet very often, and we've got, you know, 140 days to do the people's business. And so usually whether we're on the floor or off the floor, we're doing something that's legislative related. the camaraderie in the Texas House, I think, is very, very good. If you took the animosity away, if Tom Craddock weren't there, let's just be frank, because he's the one that really has driven a wedge and with a very, very strong arm style that I think no one will deny. If he were not there, we'd be back to normal in a very bipartisan manner overnight because the individual members, I think, have respect for one another, and they might all always agree or disagree, but they have respect for one another because people are down there. They're away from their families. They're away from their homes. They're not making any money, and they're doing it because they want to try to make Texas a better place.
Is trust a different matter?
Well, I mean, I think there's a high level of trust in the legislature because it's one of those things. If somebody, and I've been there for 12 years, if somebody just flat out lied to me 10 years ago, I'm going to remember that on another issue. And so you tend to be honest and forthright with people because you're going to have to deal with them on another issue the next day or the next month or maybe 4 years from now. And if you violate someone's trust, you're not going to get very far in Austin.
Texas House Democratic Leader Jim Dunham is my guest. Let's speak next to James in Dallas. Hello, James.
Yes, I wanted to ask Representative Dunham if he had any thoughts about pending legislation to increase our incentives for the film production community here in the state of Texas. I've got a lot of friends that are having to move away to neighboring states, namely Louisiana and New Mexico.
Well, you know, we spend a lot of money on economic development in the state of Texas, and the governor has this Texas Enterprise Fund where he gives away half a billion dollars or something like that every 2 years. And, we're very supportive of doing things that promote industry and innovation in the state of Texas. Our concern has always been that they're wasting money or it's been a pay-to-play situation. I mean, we spent $10 million on an interchange south of Austin for Cabela's to build a store. And they promised they'd create all these jobs. Well, you know, they didn't create the jobs, and we made them give back like $400,000. But we spent $10 million on an interchange that we didn't get it back. We spend money out of the Enterprise Fund, or the governor does, all the time on these promises of job creation, and there's no accountability for it, and these jobs are not created. You know, we ought to be spending that money on things that will, you know, like wind energy and things that will in technology that will allow business development for new ideas like that. And if we need to do something to be competitive in any market, film industry or whatever, then we need to have a responsible look at how the state can contribute to that. But the problem that we've seen is that it's been pay to play. I mean, there's a place in Waco that got, I don't know, a couple hundred thousand dollars for opening a factory there. And we're glad they're there, don't get me wrong. But right before they got the grant, the owner gave Rick Perry $25,000 campaign contribution. And we shouldn't have pay to play. You shouldn't get money whether or not you give money to the governor's fund. I mean, they have an advisory committee the governor has, and part of that is to go on dove hunts and pay to go on dove hunts with the governor. And then you can say where this money gets spent. That's not responsible use of tax dollars. And I think Democrats are very strong into economic development because, you know, I, for one, I want my kids to stay here. I want them to be able, and they can't stay here unless there's a good job for them when they get out of school.
Where would you focus wind energy money? Would it be on infrastructure construction or technological development?
Well, we have to have an ability, and I think the PUC has been, you know, there's been some news about that and what they're doing to try to allow connectivity to where, you know, we want these things in places where the wind blows and blows most often, and that tends to be West Texas, evidently. But we haven't had the transmission lines. You know, we can build all these windmills we want over there, but unless we have a way to transmit that over, then it's not going to work. But, you know, we need to have a balanced approach to energy in the state of Texas. Again, people are paying right now, highest utility rates they've ever paid. We've got to be able to do better than that. It's going to take a combined approach. Wind is not going to solve it all. We're going to have to kind of investments in wind and solar. And We just can't build more coal plants. You know, that's that, and that's been the plan. I mean, Rick Perry fast-tracked like 12 coal plants a couple of years ago, and I think people in Dallas know about that. Fortunately, we got them to back down, and but we're going to have a balanced approach, and we're going to have to put everything on the table.
Your grandfather, William Vance Dunham, served in the legislature almost a century ago.
That's right.
Was that a big part of your family sort of mythology growing up?
Well, I think like many people, I admired my grandfather just because, you know, you grow up and you got this stately man in the room, and I had a lot of admiration for him. My delving into public service was more by accident. I had an uncle that was very active in politics. He had been campaign manager for people who had run statewide and won, and frankly, he walked in one day and suggested I run for state rep. He told me I couldn't win. I was 26. He said it would be great for me to go out and meet more people. He told me again I couldn't win. And it just so happened that that was the deadline day. And if I had been allowed to sleep on it, I wouldn't have done it. But I ran, and I didn't win, but I got 49% of the vote. I was 26 and ran against an incumbent in a Republican area. And at that point, I'd been bitten by the bug and had some kids and came back and ran again, and I've got a good supportive wife and everything. And but yeah, my grandfather actually was in the legislature 80 years before I was elected, and I have pride in his service towards the state of Texas, and I feel like that we all have an obligation to give something back.
So you've now got more than a decade of service under your belt. Assuming as an incumbent that you win the election that you're in this time, what happens between November and January?
Well, I think we're going to elect a new speaker, and you'll have a speaker race going on. Tom Craddock didn't have the votes to remain in the chair in May of last year, and so he wouldn't allow us to vote. Fred Hill, actually, a state representative from here, a Republican state representative from here in Dallas, or Richardson, actually moved to unseat the speaker, and the speaker said he had absolute power and he couldn't be removed unless he gave his own permission, so which was sort of bizarre. I think Hugo Chavez might be able to do that, but I didn't know Tom Craddock could. But so he didn't have the votes in May, and since then he's lost several other votes. And I think we're going to have a new speaker, and we'll have people getting ready for the new session. I think you're going to have some new members from Dallas County and Tarrant County, and they'll get reacclimated and orientated. And second Tuesday in January, we'll be off and running.
How long does it take to get acclimated in your first session?
You know, my first session, it wasn't until the end of session that everything came together. And I remember sitting there in my chair saying, I finally get it. And in a broad sense, it took a session to see the entire process go through. You can still have a very meaningful impact as a freshman, but until you've seen the hectic days at the end of session, you haven't seen it all.
Jim Dunham represents District 57 in Waco. He is also the House Democratic leader in Texas. Jim, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.